You're listening to episode 12 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, storytellers, before we get right into this interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. Scrivener is a tool that helps writers bring their stories to life. I use Scrivener to gather all my thoughts, ideas, and research in an organized way that makes writing the chapters so much easier for me. Stay tuned for a featured interview with Io Petrucca at the end of this episode to find out how he went from an avid user and dedicated fan of Scrivener to becoming the company's head of support and the founder's general right-hand man, and also what it's like behind the scenes of his job and how he uses the software for his own writing. Be sure to stick around right after the interview for the special promo code just for our tribe of storytellers.
Hey guys, we have Aline Ohanisyan with us today, the international best-selling author of Orhan's Inheritance. Her writing was a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Award for Socially Engaged Fiction and the Glimmer Train Best New Writers Award. Orhan's Inheritance is her first novel and has been long listed for the Flannery Dunnan First Book Award. Aline, thank you so much for coming on to the show. How are you?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you fell in love with writing.
I fell in love with writing at a very young age. I first fell in love with reading. I remember the first few novels I read having completely rocked my world. I just became a voracious reader. And when I got older, and I think I was in college and still trying to figure out what to major in and what to do with my life, and thought maybe I should go to law school and make some money. And I remember someone asking me, like, what gives you the most joy in the world? What brings you joy? And I didn't even have to think twice about it. I immediately knew what that was. It was reading a novel. I was always reading two or three novels constantly. I just didn't have the courage at first to call myself a writer. I just started quietly writing just for myself without really calling myself a writer or telling anyone else I was writing. But that's how it began. It began with a love of reading, and then it just grew. And I finally dared to dream of doing it myself.
Let's say a young beginning budding writer came to you as a mentee, and he or she is like, I've been writing chapters or even writing short stories, and I still don't feel comfortable calling myself a writer yet. I don't feel that ownership. What would you advise to him or her?
I think, you know, it's okay and completely normal to be hesitant at first to call yourself a writer. Well, first I would say just keep writing. And the more you write, the more confident or comfortable you'll feel calling yourself a writer. But secondly, I think even the writers with the highest accolades sometimes have what I call the imposter syndrome. You know, they think that any minute someone's going to find out that they're not as great a writer as people think they are. I think that that's a good, healthy thing, because it's always pushing you to try harder, learn more, and push yourself in your writing to the next level. So on some level, that self-criticism or that hesitancy to call yourself a writer is healthy, but it shouldn't stop you.
Was there one or two really life-changing books that made you really get sucked into reading?
You know, I was very, very young. I started reading very early. So the books that sort of rocked my world, six or seven, are not the books that would like rock my world now. Although I do remember reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yes, that rocks everybody's world, no matter what age.
Yeah, and I have a young son, and he started reading that book particularly this year. And I really was surprised by how wonderful it was. Also, To Kill a Mockingbird is kind of a perfect novel, I think, for young people and for all people, really.
I remember having to read that specific book in school. And even till this day, I actually had to revisit it because I was watching a play. And my goodness, I was like, wow, that's really good writing. It really is a timeless classic.
It really is. There's very good reason that it's still required reading in every school. I think, you know, recently I revisited that novel because, like you, I had read it as a very young age. And when I heard that Harper Lee was coming out with a second novel, and there was a lot of controversy around that, and I was following all the articles, but I decided to reread To Kill a Mockingbird. And I just walked away really satisfied as a reader and thought, wow, you know, she did write a great novel. It's still a great novel. And it does a lot of things, this wonderful, masterful storytelling, but also really presenting the context of race relations in that time period. It's still a great book.
And talking about time periods, I'd love to segue into your book, Orhan's Inheritance. Talking about being a master at going back and forth between past and present and using different really strong voices. First, I want to talk a little bit about your inspiration behind your novel. What inspired you to write it so that our audience can learn a little bit about it if they have not checked out your book yet?
The inspiration came in two very different forms. The first was that my great-grandmother Elizabeth was a survivor of the Armenian genocide. She escaped the death marches at a very young age. And she told me the story when I was 8. She was my maternal great-grandmother, and my paternal grandparents were also genocide survivors. They actually met at an orphanage and then got married and had my dad. So I have lots of survivors in my immediate family. But what inspired this specific novel and what led me to write it is about 8 years ago, I was in a sort of sleepless, sleep-deprived state when I heard a voice, and it said two sentences about the futility of words, how you have an experience and sometimes words are just not enough. They try to impose meaning on the experience, but they just fall short. And being a lover of words and a writer, I couldn't disagree with this voice more, and I started to become extremely obsessed. I knew it was an old voice and I knew it was a female voice, but I didn't know anything else about her. So I started creating a character around those two sentences. And that character became Seda, who's one of the main characters in the novel. Just as an aside, 8 years later, the first review I ever received of the book was a Kyrgyz-starred review. And out of the 80,000 or so words the reviewer could have quoted, she quoted only two sentences. And she said that these two sentences are at the center of this book. And those were the two that she quoted.
Wow, I have chills on me right now. That's crazy. So then that's what gave you the inspiration. First, your maternal great-grandma.
Yes.
Was telling the story initially.
I was 8 when she told me that story. So I started writing this novel maybe 20 years after the fact. And the impetus was that voice that I heard. And, you know, when I couldn't really add anything more to the character, I started borrowing from my great-grandmother's life.
Okay, so now that leads me into asking about how you crafted those really powerful voices, because to switch between the narrators, I think that's really difficult to do. And I think you really did an amazing job with that. You mastered that. And it was so clear and concise. You knew exactly who was speaking. How did you go about creating such a strong voice behind each character?
Well, first of all, thank you, Yen, for saying such lovely things about the different voices. What I'll say is that some characters come fully formed. Someone like Fatma, who is this like feisty, probably my favorite character. She's funny, she's feisty, she surprises you. She surprised me every time she opened her mouth. I couldn't wait till, you know, she was on the page. Someone like her comes fully formed. Other characters take a lot more construction on the part of the author. Seda was one character that I really struggled with. I couldn't really access her thoughts. She was the character who didn't really believe that words could help. So, of course, she was silent a lot. So I couldn't hear her voice. But other characters like Fatma, you can hear them loud and clear. So I don't know how to explain that. I feel like as a writer, what does help to me is when I wrote in first person from all of these characters, just to locate their voice, stay in their voice. And, you know, when I woke up sometimes to write, I write in the early mornings. I wouldn't force myself to write in a voice that I wasn't easily slipping into, because for me, it was very important that all the characters be extremely distinct.
You were not only able to make the voices very distinct, but you were able to weave in the accurate history that you were touching upon. And you really educated me a lot about the genocide. How did you go about with the research?
I have a master's degree in history, and I was actually in a PhD program when I dropped out to write this novel.
So,
and also, this has been an obsession of mine. You know, I'm very intrigued by history. So I think if I wasn't a writer, I'd be a historian. I almost completed my PhD in history and would have been a historian had I not gotten sort of sidetracked by this novel. And I know that I'll be writing historical fiction regularly. The second novel I'm working on is also historic fiction. I did a lot of research for this particular novel. I read almost, I can easily say, every historical book I could find from Turkish historians, Armenian historians, highly regarded academics in the U.S. I read the history from many different angles. I even read denialist history, which was difficult to do. I read military histories because there are scenes where one of my characters becomes a soldier. And so I really needed to know the landscape of this history inside and out, especially because it, in certain parts of the world, like in Turkey, it's a contested history. So it was very important for me to make sure it was extremely well-researched and that all of the historical facts and scenes were extremely accurate.
You did, honestly, a phenomenal job with that.
Thank you.
How do you put your stories together? Did you use certain writing programs to help with that process?
Well, I'm a little old-fashioned, so novels and stories for me always start with a notebook, usually Moleskine and a pen. I always start there. As characters grow and I see that a story has legs, and by legs I mean I can tell it's going to be a larger, longer form, like such as a novel, then I will hop on Word, good old-fashioned Word, and start sort of transcribing what was in the notebooks and then expanding from there. And then within, on my laptop, I'll have different folders for different characters. So I'll do historical research if the character is an actual historical figure, or if it's a completely made-up character, which is usually the case. I do have one or two historical figures that did exist in Orhan's inheritance. Mary Grafham, the missionary that is the American teacher in that province, was an actual person from Rhode Island. She did exist. I have her letters and her diary entries and some articles in the New York Times where she sort of reported back to the States explaining what she was doing there and also explaining the plight of the Armenians, the atrocities that she was witnessing. So I wanted to use her real name and put her in the book so that she can be given her place in history. But yeah, I use a notebook first, like a Moleskine, and then I use Word and sometimes different files for different character names. I do a little plotting, which I think helps, but I'm not strict about that. I allow my characters to take me on detours or complete, you know, left turns from the plot.
Please tell us, were there moments when you were crafting your debut novel, if there were times you're like, oh my gosh, this is like, what have I gotten myself into? This is really difficult.
Yeah, pretty much every minute until the book was sold. Even when I got the agent, I always thought, well, when I have a real New York agent and I'll feel legitimate. And I got the agent and then I was so worried about what if she can't sell this? Like, who's going to buy it? And then even when it sold, I was like, okay, now the copy edits are going to come and I'm sure they're going to rearrange the whole book because, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. But in the end, none of that was true. This book has been blessed, but I didn't know it until the very, very end. I was discouraged often. I felt like I was delusional. Like, why am I writing this? Like, I don't know anyone in publishing. I don't think anyone's going to ever read this or publish it. So why am I waking up at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. every morning to write this novel? And so I just felt a little delusional, but I heard someone say that Marilynne Robinson once said, you have to be the master of your own obsessions. And that's exactly what it was. It was like, I had to write this story, even if it meant 5 years of my life going to complete waste. Like, I wasn't going to stop. I wasn't going to let the publishing or the worrying about the publishing stop me from the actual writing of it.
That's really admirable. It's like writing for yourself, staying true to your heart's passion and desire and just going through with it. And now talking about that, I know you mentioned that you didn't know anyone in the publishing world. So what was your process?
I wrote an incomplete book. I spent 6 years of my life writing this novel. And then I had to write a one-page letter to random agents to see if they would be my agent. And you know what? That's called a slush pile. And it's very uncommon to get an agent just by writing an email and sending it. They get 200 emails a day. So I spent 6 months crafting that query letter. I looked at my favorite books, contemporary books, and found out who represented those books. And I only queried 10 agents. So each one of those 10 agents got a letter sort of crafted specifically for them.
Did you take any courses on how to craft a really strong and powerful query letter that would catch the literary agent's attention?
Well, I didn't take any courses, but I did read as much as I could about what makes a good query letter. And then I decided that I was going to get intimately familiar with the 10 agents that I was querying. So I read the last book or two that they had represented, or read the last book they represented plus the book that led me to them in the first place. Because I knew that if they liked this particular book that was near and dear to my heart, that they would like my novel. Because in the end, we write the kind of books we love to read. And so I picked the 10 books that I absolutely loved and queried those agents. And when I sent them that letter, I made certain that they knew that I knew exactly who they were and what they had sold recently and why I had chosen them to query.
How would you advise our listeners who are in the process of reaching out to agents, but they're receiving rejection letters? Is there any words of wisdom that you can pass on or any words of encouragement?
I would say really pay attention to what an agent wants in a query letter. I've heard crazy things that people like will query an agent that only represents like commercial fiction, and they'll send him their, you know, literary novel or their idea for a cookbook or whatever. Really, it's about doing your homework about these agents, because not every agent is suitable for your novel, and it's got to be a good fit both ways. So I would say do your research about the agent and what he or she wants to represent, and then spend a lot of time on the query letters. I always offer friends a reading and editing of their query letter, and I think that's great. Have someone else look at your query letter. Make sure that it's everything it can be. I spent 6 months on my query letter. I spent 6 years writing the novel, but 6 months on that one page. From those 10 query letters, I got offered representation by 3 agents. So I feel like if you really spend a lot of time with your query letter, it helps. And also, I would also add, submitting to contests or having your work published in a literary journal helps, because the last paragraph of that query has to be about you. I mean, if you just Google like best query letters or literary query letters, you're going to get 600 hits and you should probably read 300 of them.
That is true. And I know you mentioned about submitting your work into the contest. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
On a whim, I sent this novel to the Penn Bellwether Award that's given to unpublished debut novels. And I had read 3 of the last 4 Penn Bellwether winners and loved those books. So Mudbound is one of my favorite novels, and that was a Penn Bellwether winner. And I had read Heidi Giroux's book, and I had read... So I was familiar with the kinds of books that they were giving that award to. And I just decided on a whim to send them my manuscript, again, feeling like a complete imposter and wondering if like the $12.50 postage was really worth it. Now I think back and think, thank God I spent that $12. Because, you know, when I sat down to write my query letter, the last sentence of the query letter was always letting the agent know that this book had been a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Award. And ultimately, that is the publishing house that ended up buying the book many years later when it was put up for auction.
What do you think about mentors? How do you feel about that?
Well, I've never had like a relationship with a mentor, but I have had mentors vis-a-vis their books. So I've read a lot of craft books, and I've studied certain novels over and over again, trying to deconstruct what they've done. So in my head, I have mentors, but they just haven't met me yet, or I haven't met them yet. But I am very, very familiar with their work. So I love the idea of a mentor, but I just haven't been blessed with one. I haven't had the opportunity. You know, I don't have an MFA, and I feel like that's a good place to find a mentor. I learned how to write on my own from reading and just the act of writing. Daily writing. So I don't know. I mean, I think the idea of a mentor is wonderful. I haven't had the privilege of having one. I also think that no one's going to care about your work as much as you are, ever. That's just the truth. No one can, not even your mother, you know, or your boyfriend or your husband or your lover, you know, no one's going to care as much about, and that's as it should be. You should care most about your work. The person who's the biggest advocate for your work is you. And I love the idea of a mentor. I'd apply for one if I could, but they're not easy to come by.
I guess the closest thing after that would be workshops in a way, because you're finding other people out there who have similar, like-mindedness.
Yes.
You're an alumni of Breadloaf and Squaw Valley Writers Conference, and they're both very prestigious conferences. So please let us know your experiences and what you thought about it.
Well, I think workshop is wonderful. So, and you don't have to go to a prestigious, expensive writers conference, although they're a lot of fun and I highly recommend them. But you could find a writers group. So I have a writers group here in Orange County where I live. There's about four of us. And I had one previously while I was writing this book. I was a member of a larger writers group. And we read each other's work and gave each other constructive criticism. And it was extremely helpful. It was really helpful to listen to five or six or eight people read a chapter and hear their take on it and listen to what was working and what wasn't working for them. And to also learn when to take that in and when to say, no, I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to keep it this way for these reasons. This is a wonderful thing to have in your life. If you can find someone who is also interested in writing quality fiction and you can read each other's work and be advocates for one another, it's a wonderful thing. And sometimes you find these people at writers' conferences. I love craft classes. So because I don't have an MFA, I seek these experiences where I can learn from master writers who I really admire. And every time I've been to a writers' conference, I've been privileged to learn from some wonderful writer teachers.
So for the local ones that you're mentioning, you, for example, you have one in Orange County with a group of four. It's so nice to come together and have good critical advice that can actually help shape your book and improve it. Do you have any advice on how people can find local workshops around them if they can't attend a really huge conference like Squaws?
Mine happened very organically. I don't think I should be advising anyone on that. I think it is hard to find these writers groups, but I think if you seek, you know, if you seek, you shall find. I think if you take writing classes at your local community college or look for people online. I mean, it's hard because you have to like their work and then you have to also like them as individuals to a certain degree. I think I've been very blessed, but these four people didn't just magically appear. I sort of cultivated these relationships slowly and very organically. I met one person at a reading. But if you surround yourself with literature and seek literary excellence, I think these people will come. And in the meantime, read, you know, craft novels and do everything you can for your writing. And if you continue to do that, eventually, I think the right people, whether they be workshop people, agents, friends, they will all materialize.
Now, Aline, raising two young kids when you were writing, how did you find time to do that? And did you have a structured schedule for yourself?
Yeah, for a big chunk of this novel was written at like from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning. And then I would wake up, get everybody ready for school, breakfast, all of that. And then after 9 o'clock, I would sit and maybe do a little more writing, maybe more editing, maybe plotting. But the actual sort of trance-like writing that happens in a character's voice, the creation of new scenes happened from 4 to 6 a.m. Things that happened after 9 a.m. were more of the sort of like structural editing. And there was still work around the novel. Sometimes researching was done after 9 a.m. But I did those types of things from like 9 to noon every day. I do want to tell young readers, though, I've never actually met a whole bunch of writers who can write for more than 3 hours at a stretch, because I always used to think I'm such a slacker because I could only really write for 2 hours. And then after that, it was like editing, research and other things, still book related, but I wasn't actually writing new scenes. And that's very common. So I wish somebody had told me that when I was writing this novel. So I'd like to tell your listeners that.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sure they'll take that to heart and it would make them feel better about it. Were there moments where you did get away, like retreats, to just really get a lot of writing done? Were there moments like that for you as well?
There were, but there weren't like weekends. Usually there would be like for the day. So I'd convince my husband to take the kids somewhere for the day or watch the kids for the day. And I would leave and I would write from 9 to 6, let's say. But that was like once every other month. Most of this novel was written in, like I said, 4 to 6 a.m. every morning, just on a consistent basis. And, you know, it wasn't hard to do. People always say, oh, you must be so disciplined. And it was like, no, when you're loving something so much, I loved doing it. I couldn't wait. Like, I mean, there were parts that were really hard. I don't want to sound like the whole thing was like such a picnic. There were times that were really, really difficult, but I wasn't less passionate about the work when it was difficult.
Are there any small, manageable steps that you can advise our listeners to get closer to their goals each week that they could take?
Certain writers have word count that they want to hit by the end of the week, or a number of hours they want to sit in that chair despite the word count. I think what's key is to find out the kind of writer you are and to understand your rhythms and your writing flow. And instead of asking someone else like me or any other writer, discover who you are as a writer. Know your weaknesses, know your strengths. And you can learn those strengths and weaknesses by showing other people, other writers in a workshop, your work. So I think I'm not trying to be vague, but I think that it's really dangerous for me to say, you need to write 2,000 words a day, and then that be my advice, because, you know, that might not work for everybody. It's certainly, word count has never been something I look at. In fact, I couldn't tell you what my word count was. It's not something I listen to or pay attention to. I think you really have to discover, what kind of writer are you? When do you work best? When are you more inspired? You know, what time of the day? When do you write more words? When you put your phone away? When you disconnect your internet? When you write at Starbucks versus writing at home? You have to answer all these questions for yourself and then ride your wave. Discover what your wave is and ride it until there's nothing left. And by ride, I mean R-I-D, you know? I really believe in that. That would be my best advice, is to figure out what kind of writer you are and then execute that as much as you can, as often as you can.
Tell us a bit about what you're working on next, because I know you mentioned a little bit in the very beginning that it has to do with history too, that you're going to weave that in. Could you hint a little bit about what we're going to be able to read in the future? I'm very excited.
Well, I'm writing about, all I know now is it takes place in 19th century California. I'm looking at a lot of history books about Franciscan priests, Mexican rancheros, and Native American tribe, the Gabrieleños of Southern California. So I know it's going to take place in Southern California, probably between 1830 and 1864.
And what brought that about?
I've been living in Southern California my whole life. I live in San Juan Capistrano near a mission. I feel like most of my books start with land. Like, the first novel was the land of my ancestors and where they came from. And I felt like the second novel would be about my adopted homeland, which is Southern California.
Tell us how you're able to juggle a family. How are you able to keep your relationship alive with your hubby and also be an awesome mom to your two kids?
That's a good question. When I figure it out, I'm going to write a book about it. You know, it's always a work in progress. There are times when you juggle it a little bit better and you feel a little more balanced. And then there are times where you clearly know that you've been favoring the writing over the relationships, or vice versa. There's never like continuum of perfection, but it's a struggle. But I do my best. It really helps to be married to an incredible human being who's definitely the better half of our relationship. He really is a wonderful person and has been supportive of my writing on every level. And having children can be complicated for a writer, but we just somehow make it work. You tend to create sort of self-reliant, I've just been blessed with sort of self-reliant sons who are up to a lot themselves, and they're older now. I think it's easier when the kids get older, but yeah, all those things you said, trying to carve out time, but it's all a work in progress. There are days where I fail miserably at balancing all this. So,
well, it's nice to know that you are just like us as well, and that we all should just chug along doing what we love to do, but also doing our best to make time for the ones who matter to us, because that really does count a lot at the end. Let's wrap it up with the very, very last question. I know you've been mentioning quite a few times about craft novels that you've read that have also acted in a way like your mentors throughout your writing career. Could you recommend one or two of your favorite craft novels, or any book that's helped you move your career along as a novelist?
Well, I think there are great craft books you can read, but I think the majority of learning comes from reading great literary novels. There's a long list, so I don't know where to begin. I loved Middlesex. I loved Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. Actually, I just wrote an essay for Barnes & Noble Review. They have something called guest books, and they ask authors what their like five most influential books are, and that'll be coming out next week. There are so many good ones. There's Bird by Bird. I'm looking at my shelf, my craft bookshelf, and I am a craft book junkie. So I probably have like 40 books here. I thought on writing well, Stephen King wrote probably my favorite craft book. It's called On Writing. It's really wonderful. I haven't read him very well, but it's a great craft book. I highly recommend it. I think everybody should read On Writing by Stephen King. The Fiction Editor is a good one. I could go on and on. John Truby's The Anatomy of Story was interesting. That's more for film, but I thought it interesting. Then there's this kind of more obscure one called The Art of Dramatic Writing by, I think it's pronounced Lajos Egri, E-G-R-I. That's one of my favorites. I could go on and on.
You are amazing. And thank you so much for making so much time for us.
Oh, no. It was my pleasure. It was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
And there you have it. I hope you guys enjoyed Aline's episode. Thank you so much for tuning into my 12th episode. And many thanks to Aline for sharing her journey and her actionable advice. Please say hi to Aline by visiting her on Twitter at Aline Ohanisyan. That's AlineOhanisian. Also, be sure to head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Aline Ohanisyan. If you found this episode helpful in any way, I would appreciate it so much if you could help me leave a rating and review on my podcast iTunes page. Many, many thanks in advance.
As mentioned at the top of this episode, I'd love for you to get to know the team behind Scrivener. We have Io Petraca, the head of support and the founder's general right-hand man, with us today to talk a little bit about Scrivener behind the scenes. What's your writing process like?
My writing process, I am old school. I go out with a notebook and a pen, and I just sit and write. It doesn't matter where it is, a park bench, a coffee shop, or a bookstore, or an airplane, or a train. It just doesn't matter. I always have my notebook, and I always have my pen. And when I get back home, I type it up, and that's when I kind of reiterate and think about what I wrote initially. I expand on it and change it. I just like the whole process of starting with something that takes manual effort to produce and then turning it into something digital.
That's really awesome. Are there any cool or neat little tricks or features that we might not be aware of that we should probably check out?
Well, one thing that comes to mind that is a personal favorite of mine is the ability to take several different pieces of text from your manuscript or whatever you're working on and view them together in one text editor. The way Scrivener works is it lets you cut up your work into tiny pieces so that you can have a better view of what you're working with. So kind of like a table of contents. And then you can just go and view those little pieces together as one single chunk of text, no matter how much you cut it up. And that, I guess that flexibility of being able to jump between a small piece that's very topical or one scene, if you know you're working on fiction, being able to view several different scenes together that all have to do with one character, maybe, no matter where they come from in the book.
You guys are so cool. You guys have so many awesome features. It's like, I feel like every time I'm finding new things over and over again, I'm like, what? Where did this come from?
There's a lot to it. We like to say that it's the kind of thing you can jump into, but you're going to be learning it for a long time because there's so many new things that you can do, new ways to combine features, that type of thing.
That's awesome. That kind of sounds like the best relationship ever. It's like, okay, you know it's an awesome thing, but then you jump in, it's like, whoa, it's even better than I thought every single time. So that's really cool. So I'd love to know how you got involved with Scrivener.
So have you ever heard of National Novel Writing Month?
National Novel. Oh, is that NaNoWriMo?
Yes, NaNoWriMo. I used to do that quite a lot. And there was one year, 2005, there was a post on that forum, the NaNoWriMo forum, about this new program for the Mac for writers. And I had to check it out. So I did. And I got in touch with the writer of the software. And it was Keith. That's where it went from there. We just, you know, started bouncing ideas back and forth. I really love the software. So I ended up spending a lot of time on the forum talking with other people about it.
So you actually started off as a fan.
Yes, I started off as an avid user.
That's so freaking cool. I love hearing that. I assumed that you learned about Scrivener after you got the job. I didn't realize it was the other way around.
Oh, yes. No, I was quite enthusiastic a user. I had thousands and thousands of posts and even wrote the original FAQ for frequently asked questions.
That's really amazing, actually. I think that's really cool when you get to wake up every single day working for a company that you love.
Oh, I can't even imagine a better job. Really?
So, Ayo, I'd love to know a little bit about what it's like working with the Scrivener team.
Yeah, well, that's a part of what I really love about this job is the fact that because we're all scattered around the world and we all are basically freelance for the company, we can just work freely. And for me, I almost kind of just drift in and out of work throughout the day as I have time to. I wake up in the morning and I check my email and I go through things and I have breakfast. And then I go and I do a solid, you know, few hours of just getting some good work done and going through the design emails and writing about the software and helping people on the forums. And then I take another break. And then in the afternoon, I'll do some more. So, you know, I kind of just fit it in throughout my day and just love being able to have that kind of freedom to do what I like as much as I like.
I really love hearing that. I love knowing that this brand that I am such a fan of also has such a great model set up for their employees. So, Ayo, thank you so much for your time. And that wraps it up, guys. As you can see, I'm so proud to partner with Scrivener, as I really do believe in them. And if you haven't used them yet, I really encourage you to download their free trial and check it out for yourself. I want this tool to help you as much as it's helped me. So if you decide that you do love it, Scrivener has a very special offer just for our storyteller tribe. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener and enter promo code 88cupsoftea at the checkout page for a 20% off discount. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.